This is the Sophia Mare Studios podcast. Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess, and we're the Rambling Raven Puffs.
Because Potterheads are far too nuanced to be shoved into just one Hogwarts house.
Each week, we will cover two chapters in the saga of our favorite boy wizard.
All the while exploring literary themes, tarot card exercises, and even fanfic speculations.
To connect with us, your fabulous host, and other listeners, join the Discord server for Sophomere Studios.
And to support the podcast and gain access to exclusive bonus features, consider joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/sophiamarestudios, all lowercase.
Thank you for tuning in, grab your butterbeer, and enjoy the show.
Welcome again to the Rambling Raven Puffs. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today we're covering the final two chapters of Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, The Phoenix Lament and The White Tomb. In these chapters, the complete aftermath of Dumbledore's death, Death Eater's attack, and then Dumbledore's funeral.
Yeah, not really the most uplifting chapters, but and also the last two in this book.
So. Yeah, the well, four and five weren't very and didn't really end very uplifting.
No.
Not even number three ended uplifting. It was just no one died, but there was that sense of disappointment that
escaped.
Like, since book three, none of the endings have been super uplifting.
No, I mean, they tried, like, at the very end of this, but I guess, you know, and you always know you're going to have to go spend some time at the Dursleys, so that's always pretty negative.
So, we begin right where we left off, where Harry is kneeling beside Dumbledore's body, and Hagrid's like, you know, come on, you gotta go. And he won't listen to Hagrid, but then a much smaller and warmer hand had enclosed his and was pulling him upward. And it's Ginny. So only Ginny is the one who can, you know, steer Harry away.
Yeah, well, yeah. Interesting dynamic with them in this two chapters.
Yep, and then we've got Ginny leading Harry towards the hospital wing. And Harry's like, I'm not hurt. She's like, no, but Bill is there. Everyone is there. And who else is dead? And she's like, none of us. But the Dark Mark, Malfoy said he stepped over a body. He stepped over Bill, but it's all right. He's alive. He's alive, but not what he once was. And so his deal is that he was, in essence, mauled by Fenrir Greyback, yet Fenrir Greyback was, as Dumbledore pointed out, was not transformed into a werewolf. So it's like, what are the implications of that?
Yeah, because he, like, you know, we talked about that last chapter. He's like full-time werewolf instead of like on the full moon. So, but one of the like immediate implications is that the Bill's wounds aren't healing like they thought they, you know, like Malfoy's were with the other spell.
Yeah, because Madame Pomfrey's like, no charm will work on these. Like, there's no cure for werewolf bites.
That's interesting, too.
And Lupin gives some further contest. No, I don't think Bill will be a true werewolf, but that does not mean there won't be some contamination. Those are cursed wounds. They're unlikely ever to heal fully, and Bill might have some wolfish characteristics from now on.
I guess we'll find out what that means, but yeah.
Yeah, and Ron's like, where's Dumbledore? He can fix it.
Oh my god. Oh yeah. You know, I forgot for a moment that they don't know about Dumbledore's death.
And Ron, Dumbledore's dead, said Ginny. No, Lupin looked wildly from Ginny to Harry as though hoping the latter might contradict her. But when Harry did not, Lupin collapsed into a chair beside Bill's bed, his hands over his face. So, what did you think anything at all about Lupin's reaction, particularly?
I mean, I feel like everybody has some sort of reaction to Dumbledore's death. I don't think his was like overkill. I think he had an appropriate response. I not that I'm like judging grief and telling people how to grieve, but like in akin to his relationship with Dumbledore, I think he would be upset. I don't, you know, we don't encounter too many people that aren't upset about Dumbledore's death. It makes sense. I mean, you know, all these people had a pretty, Dumbledore was pretty accepting of a lot of people that aren't easily accepted. So I'm sure that's what he's feeling a little too.
Yeah, because I honed in on Lupin's reaction thinking about, because Lupin is very much was in the same position as Hagrid in looking up to Dumbledore, especially, everyone did, but looking up to Dumbledore especially so, because like Hagrid, Lupin was in a position where it's like no other headmaster or no one else would have ever given him the chance to go to Hogwarts because of his condition. And so it's the sense of like, this was like my one ally in this world. Yeah. And it was because of this man that I was able to be in any way socialized in the normal wizarding world.
Yeah. Well, hopefully, you know, we have a continued acceptance by some of those other people that were the Phoenix with him. Yeah. But yeah. Other interesting information is coming out too. I thought this was kind of like a weird, anyway.
Weird way to find that out.
Well, just a weird, a couple little moments happen here, and it's like interesting timing, but okay. So
yeah, and Harry has to break the news that it was Snape who killed him.
Yeah.
Which, again, at least they accept his, you know, accept that that's what happened, rather than Hagrid, who is just like, oh, I know you hate Snape, or like you were hit on the head. Like, they accept it.
Yeah. Pretty quickly. I mean, I don't know. I'm probably thinking about this not from the right perspective at the moment, but yeah, they accept it pretty quickly. And then it doesn't go over well. McGonagall is, you know, says, we all wondered, but he trusted always Snape. I can't believe it. So.
Yeah. And so as we kind of figured out, you know, obviously we knew Dumbledore wasn't telling, you know, the kids, this is why Harry, this is why I trust Snape. But again, from seeing McGonagall, Lupin, like, you know, everyone, all of the adults, Dumbledore didn't share with anyone why he trusted Snape. And Harry brings up, it's like, you know, Dumbledore told me he regretted giving the information that ultimately led to my parents' demise. And Lupin is just like, and Dumbledore bought that?
Right, yeah, which is kind of surprising, because I don't know, I thought that was a little bit of an interesting exchange here. Dumbledore believes Snape was sorry James was dead. Snape hated James.
Again, and this is coming from, of all of the adult marauders that we've encountered, Remus Lupin was always the most mature and the most measured and the most, you know, I wouldn't say respect is the right word, but, you know, the least contemptuous of Snape as an adult, you know,
yeah,
was Remus. And now he's just like, Dumbledore bought that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It's very interesting.
Yeah. And McGonagall is blaming herself because she's the one who sent Flitwick to go tell Snape. And then go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, this was interesting because everybody's like trying to take the blame for it. Like, oh no, it's my fault. So.
Yeah, because even also Hermione also says it's our fault because we were watching outside Snape's office and, you know, should have put it together.
I don't know if anybody's in to blame here other than Snape himself who killed Dumbledore.
Yeah, and they still don't know how the Death Eaters got in the castle to begin with, and Harry has to explain that it was the vanishing cabinets in the Room of Requirement. And again, Ron is taking blame, not directly with Snape, but just like, you know, we were watching the Room of Requirement, but then he hit us with Peruvian darkness powder.
Which is from his lovely brothers created that. So he's kind of like, yeah, I got to tell him to not sell to them, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Which I highly doubt Malfoy Soul, you know, bought that in his name.
No.
Yeah. Like, yeah. And so that's how the Death Eaters were able to get, you know, get out of the Room of Requirement. And then luckily Ron, Ginny, and Neville ran into the Order of the Phoenix members, and then all chaos and fight ensues. And even Ginny makes the comment of like, if you hadn't have given us those drops of Felicis, the lucky potion, one of us probably would have died.
Yeah, it's pretty intense and
easy there were, cause, to forget. Yeah, because they're making note of that one Death Eater. He was just firing curses, killing curses, firing everything that was like ricocheting off the walls. And it's like, you know, a miracle that none of them got hit by something really serious.
Exactly. I'm glad they're all alive for now.
And yeah, so again, just play by play of like trying to understand exactly who was where, what was going on, people blaming themselves, just letting Snape go up the tower, just letting him go down the tower with Draco, like, and so yeah, all those details, play by play of, you know, exactly how everything transpired, where everyone was. And, you know, they hear Fox's song outside, which is like basically grief personified into song.
Very sad. Very sad. Poor Fox.
Yes. You just said that again. The Loki meme. Yeah, so sad. Anyway.
Yes. No. Oh, poor little Fox. I like him. And I'm sure he is sad.
Mm-hmm. And then Molly and Arthur and Fleur show up.
Oh, good. This was the most, I mean, I knew, I guess I forgot about Fleur because there's a big devastating event and I was like, oh yeah. So this was quite interesting, and Fleur's trying to score some, well, she's not trying to score some points, but she does score some points here.
Yeah, and because Molly's like, of course, it doesn't matter how he looks. It's not really important. But he was a very handsome little boy, always very handsome. And he was going to be married. And what do you mean by that? He was going to be married.
Yeah.
Because Fleur is not here for that. You think Bill will not wish to marry me anymore? You think because of these bites, he will not love me?
I like your French Fleur impression. I'm not going to do any.
Because it will take more than a werewolf to stop Bill loving me. You thought I would not wish to marry him, or perhaps you hoped.
Yeah, that's right.
Even in this sort of stricken sense, like, her opinion of Fleur was so low that even in the shock of just finding this out, she just thinks that Fleur is just going to peace out.
Yeah, and she's on to Mrs. Weasley, which is like, I don't know if Mrs. Weasley realized that, you know, thinking that like Fleur was just being, I mean, honestly, she's probably just being herself. And Miss Weasley is like, oh my God, she's so ridiculous. You know, they have that whole conversation at the beginning of the book. This chick is ridiculous. We hate her. And they end on a better note at the end of this.
What do I care how he looks? I am good looking enough for the both of us, I think. All these scars show that my husband is brave. Nice, I'll just do that.
Amen. Fleur, good job.
Yeah, so, yeah, and Mrs. Weasley is just, you know, shocked. Because, again, we don't know. My impression of Bill's, like, financial status, you know, as a, you know, the oldest son, you know, independent adult, I'm assuming that he's fine, but not lavish, because I'm presuming if he was super lavish that he would be helping out his parents more.
Yeah, maybe.
As an unmarried man without his own family yet.
Yeah.
Because my impression, so it's the sense of you think she's a gold digger or vain or whatever, but again, my impression never really was that Bill was super, super well off to be able to Again, not that he doesn't have qualities, but just not the type that would interest the type of gold digger they're presuming Fleur or vain person that they think Fleur is.
Yeah, I agree. Like, they don't, they kind of underestimated her love of Bill, and I don't think they'd be comfortable, but I don't know. You don't get the impression that anybody's flaunting. He's not like flaunting his money in front of his parents.
No. And Mrs. Weasley's finally like, our great aunt Muriel has a very beautiful tiara that I'm sure she can lend you for the wedding. It'll look lovely with your hair.
Oh, how nice. A peace offering. Very lovely.
Mm-hmm. And so from seeing this declaration of loyal love, we get Tonks.
We're yeah, like, this.
So, freaking... what was it? I want how surprised you were. Tell me, like, when you first read this segment, when you finally figured it out.
I felt like I did not see this coming at all. Like, I was just like, oh, okay. Because I guess in my mind, like, Tonks was kind of, I don't know. It never crossed my mind that Tonks was, had any feelings toward Lupin. I know I thought there for a second she was in love with her like distant cousin or whatever. But this surprised me.
Yeah, no, I remember first reading this and being pleasantly surprised because again, when I was younger and I wasn't fully thinking about the cousin thing, but I was like all for Sirius Tonks ship. And then I'm just like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm fine with this. It's good.
Yeah. It's different, said Lupin, barely moving his lips. Bill will not be a full werewolf. The cases are completely, but I don't care either. You know, I've told you a million times, and I've told you a million times, said Lupin, refusing to meet her eyes, staring at the floor, that I am too old for you, too poor, too dangerous. Which, again, if Potter trivia, you know, the age difference between Lupin and Tonks is not as great as the one between my husband and I. Like, mine is too.
Oh.
You know, Lupin and Tonks are 13 years apart.
Oh, okay. Okay. So. Well, still an age difference there. So it's like, it's not like Jenny and her. I mean, there's an age difference between Jenny and Hermione, or Harry, too. Man, yeah, I was really changing the story. All of a sudden, Jenny and Hermione. I guarantee there's fan fiction out there about that, I'm sure. But, yeah, so it's like, whatever.
I am not being ridiculous, said Lupin steadily. Tonks deserves someone young and whole. But she wants you, said Mr. Weasley with a small smile. And after all, Remus, young and whole men do not necessarily remain so. He gestured sadly at his son.
That is sad. And, you know, as long as everybody's consenting and there's, you know, no weirdness, it's fine.
Yeah, so, so Lupin, it seems, you know, well, what does Harry say, and then the meaning of Tonks's Patronus and her mouse-colored hair and the reason she had come running to find Dumbledore when she had heard rumors someone had been attacked by Greyback all suddenly became clear to Harry. It had not been Sirius that Tonks had fallen in love with after all. So, yeah, so it's like, so this, it suggests that, you know, Tonks has been so depressed for so long, you know, since the beginning of this book. So it's kind of left that basically at the end of book five, if, you know, Tonks in some way made her feelings known to Remus and doesn't seem that they weren't reciprocated, but Lupin has just so resigned himself to not, I don't deserve, and it's just not logistically feasible for me to presume that I can get married, that I can have a children because of my condition. Like that's just too foreign of an idea to him that he could have something so normal.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess, you know, when you've always been a bit of an outsider, it's kind of like somebody wants to do something that's a little more on the, you know, traditional side. It's kind of like messes with your head a little bit.
Okay. Yeah, and if I'm being totally honest, there was a period where it was very short-lived, like not this super, super, super long, year-long crap that Lupin made Tonks go through, but there was a very small period where my husband had a similar position as Lupin for various reasons. And I'm just like, nope, screw that.
I'm going to ask to pause for 1 second. I hear something out in the kitchen and it's, I got to make sure kittens. Okay. 1 second.
Kitties always messing things up. My kitties fell down the railing of the loft this morning, and luckily, you know, she landed on her feet. Everything's fine, but that's not a small distance in which she dropped.
Okay, sorry. If they were up to something, I don't know what it was.
They escaped by now?
I think it was Ghost, and I think she's just ornery. So I think she was playing with something, so like a spoon. They're just crazy. Anyway.
Yep.
My husband sometimes doesn't realize the sink, the dishes need to go in the sink or the wash machine, or, you know, the dishwasher. So he just leaves them out and he forgets we have curious kitties.
Oh, yeah, indeed. So, yep. So we get this revelation, and then Hagrid comes in and she's like, I've done it, Professor. I've moved him, and Ministry has been informed.
Sad, sad times.
Yep. And McGonagall calls for a meeting of the houses, Slughorn to represent Slytherin, since the previous head of Slytherin House has murdered the headmaster.
Yeah, not a good look there, Snape.
Yep, and McGonagall's like, you know, I want to talk to you, Harry, before I talk with all of them. And McGonagall, she was the deputy headmistress. So in light of Dumbledore's death, Harry surmises that makes her the headmistress now, and she's able to get into Dumbledore's office.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And he, I think I'm skipping ahead, but she's kind of wants information from Harry that he's not going to share.
Yeah. She is like, okay, what were you in Dumbledore? She wants what basically Rufus Grimmjow also asks, but.
Right. Okay. Right.
Harry's just like, but he didn't want me to tell anyone. And Professor McGonagall glared at him. Potter! Harry registered the renewal of his use of his surname. Yeah, I don't think so, said Harry, shrugging. Professor Dumbledore never told me to stop following his orders if he died. But there's one thing you should know before the Ministry. Mademoiselle's murder has been under the Imperius curse. And before McGonagall can pressure or inquire further, you know, Professor Sprout, Flitwick, and Slughorn come in, followed by Hagrid, and they're all like basically figuring out like, what are we gonna do? Should Hogwarts even be open? And like, we have to talk to the governor. It's basically all this, and there's of this little exchange about again the question of if Hogwarts closes or stays open. It's Slughorn. Personally, I don't think we're in more danger at Hogwarts than we are anywhere else, but you can't expect mothers to think like that. They'll want to keep their families close. It's only natural. So, I don't know how I feel of this notion that mothers are so irrational.
Yeah.
That they can't weigh, you know, the cost benefits or possibly see that Hogwarts as this, despite what's happened, again, like, substantially, like, just this fortified castle.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? So, yeah. So, I guess I didn't like this sort of... and again, we see it a lot in the portrayal of Molly Weasley, this idea that mothers are coddling, that they're so consumed by their love of their children that they cannot make, you know, difficult or tough decisions or analyze things properly because they're just so blinded by their love of their children. It just rubbed me the wrong way.
It feels a little dated, you know, like those kind of comments, and not every woman feels maternal. I think I struggle with that a little bit. I feel like there's just still a bit of stigma towards women that feel that, who don't feel that way. I mean, unless they have fur, I kind of don't really feel very maternal. But to kind of make that assumption is a little dated.
Yeah, you could just say families are parents, you know, you don't have to say that, oh, it's the mothers that are gonna, you know, force this issue.
Yeah, and there's some really asshole mothers out there, too, that like really don't care about anyone. I don't know. I think it feels dated.
Again, the mothers I'm thinking of that give any credence to this line of thinking is the mothers bursting in, you know, bitching about, talking about, daring to talk about gender and, you know, possibilities of gender identity and pronouns. Getting angry at teachers for not pushing anything, just literally asking the kid, what are your pronouns? Just so that the teacher knows what pronouns they're the most comfortable with.
Yeah. People get real worked up about the whole pronoun thing, and I think it's just the stupidest thing to get worked up about. Like, who cares? I mean, okay, like, let's boil it down to, like, if we want to take, like, a stance, who cares? Like, as far as if you're not going to take a stance. I understand the necessity and the reason that people put pronouns in their name. I get that. Where I'm talking about, aside from that, why is everybody so flipping worked up about, you know, I want to be they, him. Fine. Don't worry about it anymore. Just because I look like, you know, I've got long hair. I don't know. Anyway, stuff like that just irritates me. It just seems very, there are better things to have a flip out about.
Yeah, that's.
I am on the side of transgender people here. I'm not saying, I know it's what it sounds like I'm saying. I'm saying that these people that are complaining about it and asking, was upset that somebody's asking somebody's pronouns, needs to worry about something else.
I'm just thinking, I guess I grew up, I didn't have any experience like with, you know, trans people directly in high school, but a lot of, you know, gay lesbian students. It was like, it was the most, you know, LGBTQIA plus friendly place where I went to high school in that area of Southern Oregon. So again, the fact that the heteronormative family norm is the core of everything. And so the fact that trying to change that is so triggers to them such an existential crisis. And I'm just like, get over it.
Like, yeah, okay, so here's a little here's an experiment. If anybody's in therapy, if something like that upsets you, take a minute and ask yourself why. Why does that upset you so much?
Yeah.
And then work through that in therapy.
Because no one wants to go through the existential strife of changing their worldview. Anyway, again, I'm all for, again, power to our, you know, trans listeners and our, you know,
yes,
you know, our trans people. We love them. I'm just, you know, again, all this stemmed from the fact that, again, the notion of mothers being used in this way. And the only thing I could possibly think of in a modern example of this sort of stereotyping of mothers is these crazy conservative moms who, like, can't deal with the fact that the world is changing and they're being left behind. Anyway.
Get with the times. Be one of those cool moms that's like, if you're, you know, paternal or your, you know, parents turn you away, I'll take you in. Be like those people, not assholes.
And Professor McGonagall then asked, like, what are your views, Hagrid? And he's like, I don't know, Professor, that's for the heads of house. And she's like, Professor Dumbledore always valued your views, said Professor McGonagall, and so do I. Which is very sweet, because if you remember, at the very, very beginning, first chapter ever of the first book, when Dumbledore and McGonagall were waiting for Hagrid to bring Harry, she really is like, are you sure you should have left that this child is being brought by Hagrid?
Hagrid's great. He knows what's up.
Well, Hagrid, what the favorite expression that Amanda uses when she's criticizing Hagrid as a blabbermouth, like, loose lips sink ships.
Yeah, that's true.
So, like, in terms of information gathering, you know, fine, but like just other stuff, you can still trust him. But anyway.
Yeah, he, unlike Harry, who will, like, I guess he's ride or die, like, literally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's like, what about, you know, sending the students home? We could get them home tomorrow if necessary. And Harry's just like, what about Dumbledore's funeral? They should stay for the funeral or have the opportunity to stay if they want. And they're like, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, good on, that was a very mature thought, I thought, of Harry. Like,
yeah, because I guess, I don't know, because the only relative death I've experienced was my grandmother when she was visiting us. So she passed away in our house. Oh, and wow. That left quite an impression. But apart from that, like, I haven't gone through, like, the motions of, again, when someone dies and all the prep that goes in. So I'm just, to me, just having the funeral right afterwards seems crazy jarring. Like, isn't there more stuff that has to be done? But
yeah, that is something that I'm a bit fascinated with, like, death rituals and things. Shocking. I'm sorry. I'm just like, how much of a cliche it could be. Yeah, it is quite quick. I don't know. I grew up very Catholic and have been to several Catholic services. Unfortunately, I would be fine if I don't have to go to another funeral for a very long time.
Yeah, so that just thinking about all that, like what about the will? What about this? What about that?
Yeah, the logistics, there's a lot to think about in those situations. And I guess especially with Dumbledore and his kind of his stature and logistical things. And I don't think we know anything about his family, right? I don't know anything about
his family. No, we don't. And the idea, and again, this is kind of unprecedented where he wanted to be buried at Hogwarts and that hasn't happened. So I'm just, with all the Board of Governors, with all the things that are involved in like an institution like that, you know, again, suspending, not the fantasy of dragons and everything else, suspending the fantasy that this would be allowed to move forward without bureaucratic bullshit coming in.
Yeah, yeah.
Whether by Board of Governors or whether by the ministry or anything else, the fact that this was just able to happen requires me more to suspend my disbelief than wizards and dragons and all other things.
Isn't it funny the things that like, take you out of it? That's always, I don't know.
Yeah. So, and then we've got, oh, and she's like, crap, the minister, you know, and the delegation is coming, and Harry's like, can I leave? Because Harry's like, I do not want to deal with these mofos right now.
Good for him. Yeah, he's like, I've had quite the day, so just let me peace out.
Yep. And so finally he goes up to Gryffindor Tower, meets Ron in the dormitory, and it's like, Ron's like, did you get a Horcrux? And Harry's like, no, and shows him the fake locket and note.
Yeah, and he's just kind of like, he felt no curiosity at all about RAB. He doubted that he would ever feel curious again. So, I mean, he's obviously depressed. So,
yeah. And he knew without knowing how he knew it, that the Phoenix had gone, had left Hogwarts for good, just as Dumbledore had left the school, had left the world, had left Harry.
Yeah, this continues on with an interesting kind of Harry's own grief processing. It's pretty accurate, I think.
Mm-hmm. And then we move on to the very last chapter, chapter 30, The White Tomb. And basically, all lessons were suspended, all examinations were postponed. You know, parents were already gathering some of their children. The Parvati twins were gone before breakfast. And Zachariah Smith was escorted from the castle. But Seamus, again, we've seen different various sides of Seamus, but Seamus like literally was having a screaming match with his mother saying that he refused to leave until the funeral was over.
Good. Yeah, whatever. Let people mourn.
Mm-hmm. So, and then we see, you know, a powder blue carriage came with Madame Maxime.
Good old Madame Maxime. I remember her.
Madame Maxime, who descended the carriage steps and threw herself into the waiting Hagrid's arms.
How romantic.
Yep. And then Harry, Ron, and Hermione and Ginny were spending all of their time together. Ginny's exams finished. They visited the hospital wing twice a day. Neville had been discharged, but Bill remained under Madame Pomfrey's care. And he seemed, personality-wise, like, he seems lucid, he seems totally normal, except he has his scars, and he has a great liking for rare steak.
So he's got a little bit of the wolf-ishness in him.
Yeah. And Fleur just replies, so it is lucky he is marrying me, because the British overcook their meat. I have always said this.
And I have no opinion on meat, so sorry, Fleur. I can't talk about that.
Yeah, I'm very uncultured. I like it well done, because I had this one instance where I just wanted it like medium well or medium at Chili's once, and literally they waved it a few times over the fire and it was like bleeding and bleh, I was like, yeah. So I don't trust most restaurants to prepare meat well in that way.
Neither do I. Sorry.
Yes, for those who don't know yet, I have, whether temporarily or permanently, I have currently suspended my pescatarianism because for various health issues, there's no way I could live without red meat at the moment. So, disappointed myself, but there's too much going on right now.
It is all good. It's all good.
Yep. And, okay, Hermione, not the best timing with this little thing. It's interesting for us as the readers, but it's just like, Hermione, I've never had this strong of a reaction reading this bit, but it's like, Hermione,
yeah, shut up. Yeah, I was like, sit on it for a minute. And I know she's like trying to, she really, ugh, it's gross timing. There's no two ways about it. She could wait.
And the way she's like, oh, I was a little right, you know, because yeah, fuck off. She, you know, like she should have just prevented in a very factual, in terms of gathering information about Snape. She should have just said, hey, I figured, just FYI, I found out that Eileen Prince that we were talking about, that was actually Snape's mom. And just leave it at that.
Yeah, that's wild. And yeah, she didn't have to phrase it that way. Also, like, I kind of feel like, let's just get through Dumbledore's funeral before we start, like, talking about this. I know it's, like, a cool information drop, but, you know, also, they've got the summer. They can write a letter to each other. They can let the freaking, I don't know. They can let it cool a little bit before she's like, yeah, I'm so great. But
yeah, and so at first Harry's like, have you figured out RAB? And she's like, no, I've found several wizards with those initials, but none of them seem like they really could be a fit. And yeah, like the way, well, it's just, I was sort of right about the Half-Blood Prince. And it's like, you know, So I was sort of right. Snape must have been proud of being half a prince, you see. Tobias Snape was a muggle from what it's, yeah, like I was right. Like, it's like, shut.
Yeah, just don't worry about it right now. Gosh.
It's, what does it, what purpose does it serve?
At this point in time, like, yeah, there's just, no. She just needs to be quiet.
Yeah, because all she could have said is that, you know, I found out that Eileen Prince married Tobias Snape, so that must be Snape's mother. And then, that's all she could have said, and then Harry could have said, yeah, that fits. He's played up the pure blood side so he could join in, get in with Lucius Malfoy and the rest of them. He's just like Voldemort. Pure-blooded mother, muggle father, ashamed of his parentage, trying to make himself feared using the dark arts, giving himself an impressive new name, Lord Voldemort, the Half-Blood Prince.
Oh my.
Which again, Harry is kind of right, because
yeah.
Snape is very much like Voldemort in this regard.
I mean, Snape sucks, don't get me wrong. Like, I know, like I said, I feel like his motivation last, when he killed Dumbledore, there, I feel like there's more to it there. But I, unlike Dumbledore, do not think that highly of Snape.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he broke off looking out into the window. He could not stop himself dwelling upon Dumbledore's inexcusable trust in Snape.
Yeah.
You know, but as Hermione just had inadvertently reminded him, he, Harry, had been taken in just the same. In spite of the increasingly nastiness of those scribbled spells, he had refused to believe ill of the boy who had been so clever, who had helped him so much.
All right. Whatever.
because he built this image up of the prince being like this, you know, badass right. kid who, and again, he seen him as helping him, and now realizing that that was the teacher who was terrorizing him and killed the headmaster.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's
when we were discussing the Half-Blood Prince chapter, like chapter 9, when Harry first got the book, you just threw out as offhand, you know, maybe, like, maybe it could be Snape, I don't know. So you get half a point.
I get half a point. That's the fact that his mother is involved is interesting. Like Hermione's timing is not great, but yeah, I don't know. Well, so maybe there's something to my thought about him and Dumbledore, but I hope I find out in the next book. But who the hell knows?
Yeah, and they go back and forth of like he must have known immediately when I used Septum Sempra on Draco that I had the book. And why didn't he turn me in?
Because he probably would have had to turn himself in too?
Yeah, because that's Hermione's like, I don't think he wanted to associate himself with that book. You know, I don't think Dumbledore would have liked it very much if he'd known. And even if Snape pretended it hadn't been his, Slughorn would have recognized his writing at once. Anyway, the book was left in Snape's old classroom, and I'll bet Dumbledore knew his mother was called Prince.
I mean, Dumbledore knows all, and I feel like he definitely would have known. And Snape seems very, like, this is just kind of like a dirty little secret, but especially because he tells Harry about that after Dumbledore died. Right. Dumbledore's gone, that he's the Half-Blood Prince.
Yeah. Like when Because when Harry's chasing him out of the, you know, castle, and he's like, no, you're not using my own spells against me. I'm the Half-Blood Prince.
Yeah, so, like, there's no risk of Dumbledore knowing, like, finding out. So, obviously, he was kind of concerned with Dumbledore figuring this out.
And Harry's like, I should have shown the book to Dumbledore. All that time, he was showing me how Voldemort was evil when he was at school, and I had proof Snape was, too. And Hermione's like, evil is a strong word. You were the one who kept telling me the book was dangerous. I'm trying to say, Harry, that you're putting too much blame on yourself. I thought the prince seemed to have a nasty sense of humor, but I would never have guessed he was a potential killer.
Yeah. And then Ron says none of us would have guessed Snape would have killed Dumbledore, basically.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yep. And then, okay, I think I'm misinterpreting, you know, there is some space and time here. So maybe it's like a week or so between the death of Dumbledore and the funeral. So I think I misspoke earlier about the idea of the funeral just happening immediately.
Yeah, I can't.
Even so, again, just because the ministry has been so adversarial, especially towards Dumbledore, I'm still surprised that this was able to still go through.
Yeah. Yeah, it just does kind of come together pretty quick.
Mm-hmm. So let's see. Yeah, so they go out to the funeral, and, you know, everyone and their cousin is there. We've got members of the Order of Phoenix, we have Kingsley Shacklebolt, we have Moody, we have Tonks, and her hair has returned to vivid pink.
Aw, how and lovely.
And she and Remus are holding hands, and it's adorable.
Love. All the love.
Yeah, we've got Fleur, we've got Fred and George, Madame Maxime, the landlord of the Leaky Cauldron, Tom, Arabella Fig, the hairy bass player from the Weird Sisters, Ernie Prang, driver of the Nightmus, Madame Malkin of the Robe Shop in Diagon Alley, the barman at the Hogshead, and the witch who pushed the trolley on the Hogwarts Express.
So everybody's coming out for pretty much. I mean, the Weird Sisters bass player, I was wondering if that was like a distant relative of his. Because I'm just obsessed with the fact that he has no relatives that I know of.
Interesting. So yeah, they file in the seats. And then, of course, there is the Ministry of Magic delegation, which has Cornelius Fudge. It has Scrimgeour. And who else does it have? It has freaking Dolores Umbridge with a black velvet bow on her iron curls.
She can shove that bow right up her ass. So when you told me about the centaurs, you know, and then she has this like look at Ferenczi and she's like freaked out. Like when you told me about that, now I cannot get that out of my brain that she was like basically assaulted by centaurs, and I'm feel very ugh about that. So
grossed out about that.
Just like conflicted, like because it's awful, and I don't know.
Yeah, again, we have nothing to suggest that. I'm just saying, you know, nothing to suggest that whatsoever. It is just, again, when you are as much of as a nerd I am with Greek mythology, yeah, you can't let that go.
No, well, and now it's bored in my brain, so. But she sucks. I don't like her.
Yeah, she sucks, and, you know, you can see the centaurs, like, kind of huddled at the edge of the forest. We've got the mer people coming up to the shallows singing. Like, everyone loves Dumbledore.
Yeah, and Harry's, like, having flashbacks, though, for a second with these mer people.
With the mer people, and, yeah, because thinking about, because Dumbledore could speak mermish, and he's like, I never asked him how he learned mermish. Like, I never asked all of these things about him that I could have, and I didn't.
That's just doing a good thing. I mean, with grief and having lost some people in my life, it is like you always have that moment like, God, why didn't I say this? And it's just, I guess, human to think that they're going to be here. So,
yeah. And of all the guests, also Hagrid's half brother Grop is up there acting like a human.
I mean, I guess Hagrid has worked with him well.
Yes, indeed. And so I don't know, I can't remember exactly. So basically, when Dumbledore's body is, like, you know, carried over by Hagrid to the table, like, there's this huge wall of white fire and white smoke, and then it all dissipates. And I guess it's the sense of, was this intended, or did this just magically happened that poof, we have a nice pristine white tomb here, and that's Dumbledore's grave. Because I just remembered, like, okay, this is what they intended to do, but it's from the level of surprise, everyone is like, just, oh, okay.
This yeah. Is that like the typical thing? Like the body on the pyre? It's just like, I don't know. It's very interesting.
Mm-hmm. And then, so once that's done with, Harry breaks up with Ginny.
And Jenny handles it pretty well. She's like, okay, you're doing this for some noble cause, right? Like, and I mean, she's not like super tore up about it. She's just basically like, you know, whatever. But Harry also is pretty logical in that, like, look, it's gotten pretty real. And if somebody's going to come after, if Voldemort's going to come after me, which we know he is, and I'm connected to you, he's going to try to mess with you to get to me.
I mean, that is very logical. The only flaw I see in Harry's argument is that the Weasleys are all like already have, you know, such a target on their back by being blood traitors. And even if, you know, Ron is his best friend, one could make the argument that at this point he's so affiliated and embedded with the Weasleys at this point that it's moot. If it was like maybe someone else from another family who otherwise maybe could have gotten away with, you know, sinking back into the shadows, but the Weasleys, none of them are in that position because they're all like members of the Order of the Phoenix. They're all affiliated with Harry. Like, so in some ways I propose that as a counter argument.
Yeah. I think I think for dramatic effect, taking the romantic partner as a means to get to that other person, it's always just feels a little, it's a little twist the knife a little bit. But maybe that's because I'm a romantic. I don't know. I know Harry's pretty enmeshed in the Weasley family. But romantically linked, I think, just adds another level. So I don't know if this is a bit of foreshadowing here or not, but Jenny, so Harry's like trying to be like logical. I truly think that that's his reason. I don't think he dislikes Jenny now. I think he's like, I'm about to play the long game. And this is just a step I need to take.
Yep. And so, yeah, so she takes it, you know, surprisingly well and is just like, yeah, I kind of figured that you would never be satisfied until you were done with Voldemort. Maybe that's why I like you so much.
Power to Jenny. She's totally fine. Much different reaction than Cho Chang, right?
Indeed. And so Harry goes up, going down for a little walk, and who should show up? Rufus Scrimgeour, this bastard.
Yeah, and Harry's like having none of it. He's like, what do you want?
He's like, what do you want, Harry? This was a dreadful tragedy. What do you want? You are, of course, devastated. What do you want?
Right, yeah. He's like, I'm not playing this game. Let's just get this over with.
Yeah, well, like, there were two broomsticks up there. The ministry can add two and two, Harry. Glad to hear it, said Harry. Well, where I went with Dumbledore and what we did is my business. He didn't want people to know. Such loyalty is admirable, of course, said Scrimgeour, who seemed to be restraining his irritation with difficulty. But Dumbledore is gone, Harry. He's gone. Yeah, I'm not saying... Yeah, he's like, he will only be gone from the school when none here are loyal to him, said Harry. My dear boy, even Dumbledore cannot return from... I'm not saying he can. You wouldn't understand, but I've got nothing to tell you. Scrimgeour hesitated. The ministry can offer you all sorts of protection, you know, Harry. I would be delighted to place a couple of my Auros at your service. Harry laughed. Voldemort wants to kill me himself, and Auros won't stop him, so thanks for the offer, but no thanks. So, Scrimgeour, his voice cold now, the request I made of you at Christmas... What request? Oh, have you released Dan Shunpike yet? They still have this stupid Stan Shunpike in custody.
That's very upsetting.
That it's been months.
In Azkaban, right?
It's been 6 months since Christmas. Let alone who would, you know. I guess it infuriates me because now as an older adult and even at certain rereadings of me now being in my 30s, the sadness and indignation of how true that is, that that institutions, be they governmental or corporate, or I don't understand this huge, you know, portraying the extreme right or the extreme left as the ultimate evil. And it's like, whether it's the government or a private corporation, evil is evil.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so, but just, yeah, the idea of whether it's a government, a corp, you know, corporate institution, any large organization, the fact that, you know, they will, to me, it's more important, you know, in our judicial system that a innocent person walks free than to punish a guilty person.
Yeah. I mean, it's absolutely horrifying to think an innocent person could be locked up. And there are plenty of them and plenty that have been executed, even though they, I mean, that's a big argument.
Yeah, like
some people against the death penalty, maybe me, you execute one innocent person, that's one too many. Like, that's all.
Yeah. There was, I forget their exact name. They're like conservatives concerned with the death penalty. And it's basically a group of conservatives that's just like, again, it was just exposing, you know, why people who are so pro-life in the abortion issue, why they're so for the death penalty. And, you know, and this girl who was part of this, you know, conservatives concerned with death penalty, she's like, even if you're framing your argument that only innocent life, 1 out of 10 people on death row has been fully exonerated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And her saying, like, who gets the death penalty? It's people who kill, it's black people who kill white people.
Yeah.
More so than anything else. So
it is.
The fact that they still have Stan Chung Pai is just so infuriating to me. And again, infuriating as I was just editing this episode. So, you know, of the very frosty Christmas. So I was just listening to us today talk about our discussion of Rufus Scrimgeour's offer and revisiting that issue. And now it's come full circle tonight by getting Scrimgeour back here. And again, just the level of entitlement that Rufus Scrimgeour has that he does nothing. Here he does a little to negotiate, like, I have auras that can protect you. Like, just not willing to negotiate in any way with Harry about, you know, to get what he wants out of Harry. And it's like, okay, if he's such a pipsqueak that you don't want to negotiate with him, then leave him alone.
Right, yeah.
Like, if he's so beneath you, you know. But yeah. Again, super entitled, and I cannot believe that this man was the head of the Auror office.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty kind of, Aurors seem to be a little bit more held in higher regard.
They're supposed to be all badass, like Kingsley and Tonks.
Yeah, this guy's just a bad apple.
Yeah. And Harry's like, Dumbledore's man, through and through, that's right. And Scrimgeour glared at him for another moment, then turned and limped away without another word.
Get out of here. That's what I say.
Yeah. And, you know, we have a little conversation with Hermione and Ron. It's like, what Scrimgeour want? Same thing as before. And Ron's like, look, let me go back and hit Percy. No, it'll make me feel better.
That's fine. Yeah. Yeah, Percy.
Yeah.
Because Percy is on that dark side.
Percy, yeah. Again, it's like a lot of people on the political spectrum where, even when something's been disproven or things are starting to look bad, there's no face-saving way out of it. So you just dig in your heels and just continue with it, because that is considered less painful than going on with something you know is not true or you know is bad.
I mean, be wrong. It's fine. I'm wrong all the time. I'm like, I don't care. I was just listening to a book about the insurrection, and it's just super upsetting, all these politicians who, you know, really kind of did exactly that. They're like, dug their heels in, like, it was just like a tour of the Capitol. No, it wasn't.
Yeah, tour of the day. And or now we're saying, yeah, it was an insurrection and it was deserved. As if we live in Iran or wherever.
Oh my God. Yeah. No.
Yeah. So it's awful. So Harry's like, you know, I'm not coming back to Hogwarts. Got a mission to do.
I call BS on that, Harry, but I guess I'll find out.
So and then Harry's and Ron and Hermione are like, we're going to come with you.
Okay. Well, whatever. I don't know what's going to happen next. So I have no idea. I know the littlest about book 7. Because
at this point, Harry's saying he'll go to the Dursleys one more time, because that's what Dumbledore wanted. then I probably will go to Godric's Hollow, and then I gotta get these goddamn Horcruxes.
Get the Horcruxes, even though I can't say the word.
Yeah, gotta catch them all. They're like Pokemon.
Yeah. Harry Potter Pokemon.
Yep. And then Ron's like, okay, but before you do any of that, you gotta come to Bill and Fleur's wedding. Harry looked at him, startled. The idea that anything as normal as a wedding could still exist seemed incredible and yet wonderful.
How romantic.
He felt his heart lift at the thought that there was still one last golden day of peace left to enjoy with Ron and Hermione.
Before the S goes down.
And at page 652, that is the end of the Half-Blood Prince. I'm looking at all the zillions of little tabs in your copy of your book.
Yeah, that's I do read it. I do read it. Yeah, wow. Okay. And now we got the next. Am I ready? I don't know. We're close to the end. One more book.
Dang. One more book. And so, yeah, I'll save your overall thoughts and impressions for when we do our wrap up next week.
I will have them ready.
Yes. So, are you ready for Gothic Geek Out?
I sure hope so. And I'm going to go for the 100 millionth time with the Gothic monster. So, the werewolf. And, yeah.
Yes, and the aftermath of Bill.
Yeah, and just kind of like the implications of a werewolf bite and just how that is different, you know, mythology. And one thing that I like in this world that we are learning about is how they take kind of typical Gothic monsters and do have kind of like a unique spin on their, you know, traditional nature. Like with this werewolf, the fact that we have somebody that is a werewolf more often than he is, that is kind of gone from a, oh, it's a full moon and I transform to a, I'm pretty much always a werewolf, and the implications of being bitten by somebody in that form are very interesting to me. So
of course, you know, werewolf. And as you know, my whole project for National Novel Writing Month, NaNoWriMo, is my post-apocalyptic werewolf thriller where, you know, I'm still developing, you know, the world building of the nature of lycanthropy. And for me, it's more structured as a virus. But this did also get me thinking about, like, what are the nature of, like, certain wounds? And because obviously I have it so that if you're bitten, then you're transformed. But what if you just have a scratch or, like, you know, I wasn't thinking about it. But yeah, I should make a point with some characters of roughing them up like Bill, that they probably have so many scars now, because again, this is a post-apocalyptic little village.
Yeah, that's interesting to add those nuances. So if there's a Gothic monster, I'll take it in a chapter.
Yes. So yep, werewolves. And then there are plenty also of you know, people love the vampire romances. There are plenty of werewolf romances as well, and we get some of that with Tonks and Lupin. My favorite werewolf romance is from the Darkest London series. It's the second one, called Moon Glow.
Okay.
So yeah, so that was, that's one of my favorites so far in regards to werewolf romance. Because, and you know, again, with the notion of Tonks and Lupin, I don't think it's a coincidence in terms of Lupin and Tonks having romantic interest in each other, because even though it's a different type of shape-shifting, Tonks is a metamorph magus. She can't shift into an animal, but she can shape-shift into various forms of humans, like from an old lady to like whatever. And so I think there is some sort of kinship in the fact that they're both shape-shifters of some, in some capacity, that helps that them sense. Have, that helps them have common ground.
That, that makes a lot of sense to have that kinship.
Yeah, and then we find out that we were all led to believe that her changed Patronus was Sirius's Animagus form, when in actuality it was Remus's werewolf form.
How romantic. But I mean, romance, it takes different, you know, all kinds of different kinds of romance. So
yeah, well, there's plenty of horror romance out there with werewolves. Although I am being very insistent in my novel. I am not going into that whole alpha beta crap.
Like, yeah.
Omega, like that seems really upset, that people seem really obsessed with when it comes to like, because I'll get like things on, you know, my news feed for like, you know, some form of fantasy erotica or whatever. And, you know, yeah. And with like werewolves, again, the alpha male and like all these things. And it's like, I am avoiding that at all cost. Like the werewolves have a tribe, have their own tribe, but they're still lucid human. They're still, most of them are lucid humans, and we're not doing that alpha beta crap.
Yeah, that's a little, I mean, I guess to each their own. You made me think of something when you were talking about werewolf romances. There is an Instagram account called Goodreads_reviews. And there was like a romance called A Very COVID Christmas or something. So, and it was like the COVID thing had been personified. I don't know. It's a really hilarious account.
It's, I think I used to stay up to date with the booktuber, like Read With Cindy.
Oh, okay.
She's one of the most prominent higher up booktubers. And I think I think it's 16 pages long, but it's just this sort of like, or, you know, again, that sort of erotica of the coronavirus personified, and she screws the coronavirus, and it's weird. And I'm like,
to each their own. I'm not my preference, yeah. But that's funny.
So, well, yeah, werewolves, one of the most traditional gothic monsters and horror monsters, and the only thing I also kind of thought of was Rufus Scrimgeour, specifically coming towards Harry. I guess I was thinking more of the archetype, or the character who like shows up after someone has died, like a vulture who is like looking for something out of the someone who has inherited whatever from the dead person. And so I was just thinking of that. Just that, I felt that was a kind of gothic vibe, that the minute Dumbledore dies, here's Rufus Scrimgeour, you know. Yeah. Thinking he can sneak in and finally get Harry Potter to do what he wants.
That's a good one too. I mean, you know, really, like, the gothic deals so much with death. So that's, I mean, in these two gothic chapters are,
deals yeah. with death, deals with inheritance drama, you know, contesting wills, you know, hidden wills, forged wills, all of that stuff. And so, yeah, just the idea of this sort of person coming in immediately after someone dies. And it's like, yep, that happens a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, good gothic stuff there.
Yeah. Yep. All righty then. Any further thoughts on gothic?
No, I mean, I guess we could talk about, you know, like I said, like, death is usually a pretty prevalent gothic thing, but
mm-hmm. I don't know. So yeah, and then we can move on to Tarot of the Day, and I just picked it right now at random, and ironic that we were talking about werewolves, because the card I chose is the major card, major arcana card number 18, the Moon.
Ooh! Ow!
Yes, the Moon, which is all about intuition and sort of mysticism, and possibly in the sense of illusions and disillusions.
Okay.
So let's see. What exactly do they say here about the Moon? In a dreamlike state, the crow rests on a branch, staring at the moon as it reflects a darker image of herself, her dark side. Below the crow, there is a pond which represents the subconscious mind, with a cage draped and symbolizing her wild side that she attempts to restrain. It is the part of herself that she tries to conceal because it evokes feeling of shame. The moon illuminates areas where we project our insecurities. In doing so, we fall victim to our own harmful powers that may have infiltrated the psyche. Sit by the light of the moon and travel inwards to find areas where fear and anxiety have taken control. The moon asks, what are you concealing? Learn to recognize and accept all parts of our being. Okay, so yeah, so also another interesting notion connecting to werewolves, because so often in literature, werewolves are associated, and vampires as well, just the darker side of human nature being personified in this monstrous way.
Yeah, and you know, like Dracula and vampires specifically dealing with sexuality and, you know, things like that. I don't know if I've read a lot about werewolves and kind of, you know, I mean, definitely with Dracula and the Victorian, like, modesty, and that was kind of super sexy vampires.
I feel like in modern context, again, with all this erotica that the werewolf has taken on, that, you know, being like the beast within and stuff like that. In terms of that specific meaning in regards to the chapters we read, I affiliate it with dissecting Snape. Mm. Both the way people were dissecting Snape in these chapters to try and think of, you know, he was an asshole, but none of us, you know, anticipated this. And so what are the darker elements of his that he concealed again? And as Hermione pointed out, which again, Hermione could tell him, but she just didn't have to be in your face. I told you so about it.
Right. Yes.
So, you know, in getting these pieces about Snape in his past is like, okay, yeah, he was a half-blood, you know, muggle father, witch mother. And we already know from Snape or Harry accidentally seeing Snape's memories that his father was abusive.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know, man. I have a hard time with Snape because I think he's an asshole and I don't care about him right now. And Malfoy too, who, you know, is absent as well. I don't think we talked about that too much,
You know, we didn't mention it in the main part of the episode, but Harry in those chapters realizes that Draco wasn't going to kill Dumbledore and finally had a little bit of pity for him that, oh my God, he is trapped in this horrible, you know, kill or be killed situation.
Yeah, he is. And, also gone, which is just like, it's just weird that, you know, he's always been kind of this presence that's like, it's kind of menacing, but never really done any harm. And no, he didn't kill Dumbledore, but he ran off with the Death Eaters. So I guess he picked his side there.
Well, when Dumbledore's dead, then I doubt, you know, the only person he was going to trust was Dumbledore. It's not like he was going to go, Draco could go to the other order members, be like, you know, put his hands up, please give me sanctuary.
Didn't do it. Yeah. Yeah. Very true. And Snape seemed to be really concerned with his, like, care at the end of that.
So yeah, in terms, again, the darker side, you know, where we house all our fears and insecurities. Again, Snape is the bigger one. Also trying to dissect Dumbledore a little bit in not so much darker side, but more just the deeper side of, you know, how could Dumbledore be so foolish and trusting Snape and all those things? And they keep racking their brains about that.
Yeah, because he trusted him for a reason, everybody. I'm giving Dumbledore credit. There's got to be a reason. I also think it's good to mention, I think darkness is often associated with death. And I have been to many a funeral that it's a beautiful spring day. And that just feels so wrong when, you know, I mean, it, obviously that the entire world isn't mourning for your whatever loss you're dealing with. But I think Harry makes a note of that too, that it was a beautiful day when they're doing Dumbledore's funeral and how that felt kind of like, doesn't feel right.
Yeah. Alrighty then. So I also picked our Black Moon Astrology card of the day. And it's just funny because we were talking about the zodiac sign off mic right before we started. Capricorn.
Oh, that's funny. It's kind of creepy
too. Yeah, because we were just starting. When it made us trigger? Oh, yeah. By the time we start, you know, after Christmas and start recording again, that will be in Capricorn, like, time. And then I was making a comment that we will actually start recording book 7 on the same date as Snape's birthday, because he is a Capricorn.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if we just, Capricorn, I use... It is time to focus on your objectives and not let up. Ruled by Saturn, the planet of hard luck, the sign of Capricorn is personified by the goat that climbs the steepest cliffs to gain worldly success. Capricorn is a resourceful sign, and those under its influence long for power and prestige.
Mm-hmm.
There is no one more ambitious than Capricorn. They really do want to take the world by the horns. Thoughts?
I I'm making a note here. I know we didn't talk about him in the like big part of the episode, but I'm going to talk about Malfoy. Cause like, I thought that, you know, he's kind of why he's in this position anyway, a little bit. He's always been very like, I'm, you know, above you, everybody. And, the I use part, I don't know. We could talk about Scrimshaw or whatever the hell that guy's name is. Yeah. He's wanting to use Harry for his gain as well.
Yeah. I think of Snape in terms of wanting power and prestige. And so Harry calls it out again. Like, he was exactly like Voldemort, where he was a half-blood in a pure-blood dominant society and decided that I'm gonna, you know, downplay this side and just be super powerful so no one will fuck with me.
Yeah. Well, worked out for you there, didn't it?
Snape. Yep. And there are more spiritual Capricorns, but the aim of most Capricorns is fundamentally practical in nature, which goes with, coincides with Snape's sense of Machiavellianism, where the ends justify the means. There is no Snape that I think is out in a field meditating with incense, searching for inner peace. I don't think there is. Snape is doing that during his free period.
I don't think so either. And I also think that's why my zodiac sign is kind of such the opposite of a Capricorn, a Cancer, because it's all emotions and not really practicality. So,
yeah. So when Capricorns do indulge in dreams, they always dream big. They are insanely ambitious. Capricorns appear mature early in life and they grow younger and younger with each passing year. Is it? I don't know what that means. When the Capricorn card turns up in a reading, it denotes a time of diligence and hard work. So, yeah, the hard work of keeping your cover until you can kill Dumbledore.
Yeah. See, that's not falling for. There was a promise made. There was a promise made.
And so, yeah, Capricorns, the ultimate Capricorn. And I guess in terms of Snape, you know, again, seeking power, being very powerful, like when we find out that Snape is the Half-Blood Prince and Harry feels so dejected that all these spells and dark spells like Septum Sempra were written by Snape. We did get a little bit of this when whether it's Remus or Sirius, Harry did get some info from those guys, from the Marauders, basically saying, you know, Snape knew more dark curses in like his first or second year than all of the seventh years. That kid loved the dark arts, and I don't care what impression you got of your father in that memory, your dad always hated the dark arts, always.
That's really interesting that there's such strong feelings both ways, you know. I don't know. I've been thinking a lot about some of those things. And interest in darkness doesn't necessarily mean a dark person. But
yes, like, as I'm learning in the book I'm reading, Nocturnal Witchcraft, where I think I found my niche, where it's dividing, you know, the sense of good and evil into four bits. So you're either light good, which is the traditional good. You're either light evil, where like a crazy Tevangelicus, where you're in the trappings of goodness, but you're evil. Then there's, you know, dark evil, which is like the stereotypical, like crazy occultist, Satanist. And then there's good dark.
Good. That is I feel like that's a place where I definitely feel comfortable, but just like if I was like an interest in the dark things does not mean a dark person.
Yes, indeed. And it does not. And, you know, obviously I've done podcasts about Jane Austen, like not all of what I've done in relation to podcasting or BookTube is about gothic literature, but definitely the stuff that gains the most momentum and the most views I have on BookTube are my specific gothic related stuff. So even though I've done plenty of things in fantasy and other things, definitely what I'm known for on YouTube and podcasting in terms of how all the hits we're getting on Sublimely Gothic, even though we don't keep making episodes, basically what I'm known for is the dark stuff.
Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. Alrighty. And then We move on to the final exercise, fan fiction time.
My fan fiction this time was, what if McGonagall took the same approach as Dumbledore in that, like, I trust Severus Snape completely. You know, she kind of is like, huh, that was weird. What if she kind of had the same allegiance and she seemed very surprised. Like, I can't believe it. Dumbledore trusted him completely. I was thinking, what if her reaction was like, I trust him as well.
Could she pull that off even after Snape kills Dumbledore? Like, what?
I don't know.
Like, what can possibly, unless there was something secret that McGonagall already knew, but it doesn't seem she does, if there is anything. So how would that work?
Yeah, that's kind of, I mean, like, what if that was her reaction? Then it probably, the thought would be she was in on it, and she'd probably, like, be in Azkaban, I guess, which would be pretty intense because she's like an old lady.
Evil McGonagall.
Yeah, yeah. Dark McGonagall. Dark evil McGonagall. But yeah, I don't know. I just, would be a strange reaction.
Yeah, because that's a trick. Because also, like Slughorn, McGonagall's in a position where she taught Snape when he was a child.
Yeah.
So she probably understands the dynamic, you know, of any of the teachers short of Dumbledore. She probably understands the dynamics of, as an observer, as a teacher, watching Snape and the Marauders when they were kids and seeing them as adults. She probably understands it more so than the others short of Dumbledore.
Yeah, I don't know. I couldn't, you know, I didn't really have a lot of fan fiction thoughts this week, but that was my only one. What if her reaction was a little different?
If her reaction was different, then, because if she was gonna continue, I trust Snape, then that would imply that maybe she knows something, and I would interpret it as she's just gonna play along, but she's gonna be thinking about, like, what am I gonna do when Snape shows up again?
Yeah.
Like, that would be a very, again, I would love that, to see that internal thoughts of McGonagall, you know, but this is sadly written in Harry's perspective.
Yes. What was yours this week?
Well, I wasn't thinking of it until 7:55 p.m. right before we started.
That makes two of us. and I
again, asked it was the fir- it's time. The first day working since Thanksgiving break. Like, yes. Like, what can the listeners expect?
Yeah.
So
we've got big deadlines at work, so yeah.
Yes, we do. So especially for me, because I wasn't supposed to take the whole week off, but I did because I had another health issue flare up. So yeah, that was fun. So anyway, my fan fiction what if is, here's a dark turn. What if Bill became a full werewolf?
I don't know if Fleur would have the same reaction that she did. I feel like the werewolf community is still so ostracized and kind of not, I just don't know if her love goes that far.
I think it does. I think, well, it's just,
let me back up. What are we talking, like, Lupin werewolf? Or are we talking full-time werewolf?
I'm talking about you know, again, he's like his normal self, except he's scarred up. And then on the full moon, he has to be a werewolf.
Okay. Then I think she would be fine. But I was thinking,
okay, because were you interpreting that? Because I think you're, and again, I'm not saying this is right or wrong, because this is getting into deep Potter shit that LeakyCon is devoted to, and they do every year for the, all just to nerd out like this. But it seems as though you're putting some, like, magical strength and magic onto Fenrir Greyback's non-werewolf form, and that by Bill being attacked the way he has been, he would be identical to that. Whereas, yes, I'm just interpreting it in that Fenrir Greyback is a quote-unquote normal werewolf, in terms that he only transforms in the full moon. He's just a sick fuck cannibal who likes to act like a werewolf all the time, even though he's not a wolf in that very moment most of the time.
Okay, yeah. The implications of that, then, like, that is I just think the unknown part, you know, because Greyback is like full-time crazy. I think I'm not really quite understanding him. He's not like presenting as a werewolf full-time though, right?
Yeah, he's just, no, he's just a really sick, twisted fuck.
He's just like a cannibal who's also a werewolf. Okay.
Yeah, who's a werewolf, you know, once a month. So again, I'm interpreting it as what if Bill was like a Lupin werewolf, like the normal werewolf.
I mean, for if we're talking a Fleur part, I think she'd be able to manage that and hopefully help him out. But the rest of the Weasley family, I don't know. They're fine with Remus Lupin, right?
Yeah, so. No. I guess the one thing would be is would Bill be able to keep his job because there's such prejudice and all of that?
That's a good question.
And he doesn't work directly with wizards. Like, he works for the bank, which is mostly goblins. So I don't know if that would change anything. But it's just, again, it's just such a stigmatized condition to have that just what would life look like being a werewolf, even a normal werewolf, even if you have a supportive family, basically just having another Lupin who's a really nice person but just keeps getting shit on by society.
I guess he would at least have an ally in Lupin. That would probably be good. I don't know. That would be well, let's hope it's not that far. We don't know though, as of right now, right? We don't know.
I don't know if a full moon has passed. It didn't mention that in the period between the death and the funeral. So at this point, he just seems normal and he just likes his steak more rare now.
Well, that's fine. Just keep it there. Like, don't start eating people. I don't know.
Yeah. So yeah, that's all I had. That's the best I can do being forced to work in a job that isn't so great, you know, right after Thanksgiving break.
Yeah, it's a bit exhausting.
Yeah. Alrighty then. Thus concludes this episode of Rambling Raven Pups. Tune in next week and we will do our wrap-up of book 4 with our various questions and wrapping up with our, you know, overall impressions and all that good stuff. Catch you guys later. Bye. Bye. Thank you for listening to the Rambling Raven Pups. Our theme music was composed by John Williams, recreated by Kinez Norwar. This podcast is but one of the many shows produced by Sophie Mare Studios. You can get the latest news by following our social media, Sophie Mare Studios on Instagram, Sophie Mare Studios on TikTok, and SophieMare_pods on Twitter. You can connect with other listeners through the Sophie Mare Studios Discord server. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/SophieMareStudios, all lowercase. Higher tiers get access to even cooler perks. That was the Sophie Mare Studios podcast.